I neglected to wish you all a happy Thanksgiving, which is coming up in a few days. We look forward to that. Do you know I didn't mention it in my letter in the FAR, but at one time, the American turkey, was being considered as our national bird. And then they probably would have roasted eagles for Thanksgiving, and we wouldn't be able to take part in the holiday. So. No, I'm sure they wouldn't have done that. Benjamin Franklin thought that the turkey should be the American bird, the national bird. Could you imagine a turkey perched on top of flagpole? It just doesn't have the same pizzazz. It doesn't have the same symbolism from ancient Israel either, so I don't think there was any worry that God wasn't going to let that happen. But in another way, the turkey might be considered our national bird because it gets phenomenal publicity around Thanksgiving time as a main course of dinner. Well, that's good. Anyway, we do wish you all a happy Thanksgiving and looking forward to some relaxed fellowship and a good meal ourselves on that day. Well, and to jump right into this, this is a sermon that I have given 4 or 5 times. It's the first time I've given it, though, this side of the Mississippi River. So I don't know if you're honored or not, but I think you'll find it interesting as we get into it. There are a few things I need to read. There was something strange about this lion, and I didn't find out what it was until it had almost killed me. He's going to tear my head off, the terrifying thought flashed through my mind as the lion straddling me opened his bloodied mouth and lowered his head toward my face. I was going to die. I hoped it would be fast and painless, but I knew it couldn't be. My rifle bullets had disabled the lion enough to change him from an efficient killer into a dazed, crazed beast, capable of only slowly and agonizingly tearing me to shreds. But I couldn't die. I had to fight back. I had to do something. What? I couldn't run. The lion had mangled one of my legs in his first charge. I couldn't shoot. I had nothing to shoot with. And on the same charge, he snatched the rifle from me and flung it out of reach. When that foul, stinking mouth was only inches from my face, I forced my arms up, thrust both of my hands between his jaws, grasped his tongue, and jerked on it with all my strength. The tongue was rough, rasp-like, easy to grip. I grabbed it tight and held on. And to make sure make my grasp even tighter, I wedged my left elbow into one side of the lion's mouth to gain some leverage. The lion swung his head away, but I hung on to the tongue desperately. The roar from the lion's throat came out as a stinking gurgle in my face. His teeth came down on my elbow, and I heard a cracking sound. Hope nobody's faint apart here, you know. A fang went into my wrist and severed arteries spurted blood into my face. Pain roared through my guts. The sky began to tilt and darken. No, I said to myself, you can't pass out. You've got to fight. You wretched beast, I shouted. You stinking, godless devil. How appropriate. You can't kill me. I'll jerk your tongue out of your guts before I'll let you kill me. You switch to the vernacular in those kind of circumstances. True story, by the way. For a moment, the big cat lay still, his eyes unblinking. Then his forelegs circled around behind me, and I felt his claws digging into my back. I closed my eyes and waited for the ripping convulsions that would tear the muscles from my back, but the lion just held me tight. I'm still alive, I told myself, and opening my eyes and staring into the sun, I said, look, the sun is red. But maybe I'm dead, and I've gone to the place where the sun is always red. Or maybe it's only the blood in my eyes. Blink your eyes and see. I blinked. The sun was white. Seized at the same voice within me, a dream within a dream. You're alive, but in a terrible fix. I struggled to clear my mind, but the only thought that came to me was how stupid I'd been to get in such a foul up. Now, to give you the short story of what happened, he was a rancher in what was called Rhodesia in 1965, now it's called Zimbabwe. And our neighboring rancher had to go to the city and asked him to keep an eye on his cattle because they always had marauding lions that would kill cattle. So they had to, you know, all the cattle killers got killed themselves, if at all possible. And he went over and, sure enough, he took a friend who happened to drop by and who was just a camera guy. And so he carried his camera, but the rancher carried a .458 Winchester Magnum, a big elephant gun for any big game in Africa. and drove over there, and they found a herd of the cattle near one of their corrals or enclosures, but there was a pride of 11 lions stalking the cattle. So he got out to chase them off. Normally they'd run when the ranchers show up, because a vehicle always means danger to the lions, and it's even worse when one of them gets out with a thunder stick in his hand. So what happened next? He started walking down and said, a couple of these beggars are getting a bit too cheeky, English language, which is amazing for an American. This guy had been a Texas Ranger for a while before he went to Zimbabwe or to Rhodesia. They mean business, and I might as well get them sorted out. Getting out of the truck, I bolted the shell into the rifle chamber and started on foot toward the lions. Most of them had stopped grumbling and were moving away at a slow trot, but two turned and came toward me. One came close enough to convince me he was deadly serious. I leveled the rifle's express sight at a spot between his eyes and killed him in his tracks. His companion wheeled and galloped off. Then what happened next took place with stunning speed. Another lion I hadn't seen before, a big character with a full mane, stepped out of a low bramble a few yards ahead, gave a hissing snarl, and crouching low, the huge cat rushed toward me. He didn't seem to come in the bounding leap shown in cartoons and described in adventure fiction, but in jerky, snake-like, zigzagging angles. I had the front sight bead of my rifle on his eyes when he covered the remaining 2 feet between us. Just as my finger tightened on the trigger, the lion skidded to a stop, throwing dirt all over me. Then he backed off, snarling over his shoulder and slashing at the brush. The charge had been so unexpected, I had to aim the rifle by sheer reflex. Now the lion backed off, I tried to size up the situation. I'd been a fool not to have taken into account the screen of brush and tall grass before getting so close. The question now was whether I should shoot him or just let him join the others. I should kill him, I thought, but he's a fine animal, too magnificent to be shot as a cattle thief. The lion whirled and came for me again, and again I was about to put a bullet in his brain when he skidded to a stop and retreated. Lions will sometimes make fake charges to bluff enemies, but something about the way this one twitched his tail and ran low to the ground told me he wasn't bluffing. Backing off slowly and stepping sideways, the lion obviously was working into a great rage, snarling and biting and ripping the brush. He's got his courage up now, I said to myself. He won't stop again. You've got to shoot. The bullet from the heavy magnum took him under the right eye, lifting him into the air and throwing him backwards into a stand of mopane brush. I couldn't see him clearly enough for a good shot, and my second round only grazed his neck. A second later, he came out of the brush and ducked behind a dead tree a few feet away. It threw me off guard. I thought he was looking for a better hiding place, but then he was on me. I barely had time to open the bolt when the lion smashed into me, his front legs hitting me in the face and chest and knocking me backwards. For an instant, the rifle muzzle was in his mouth. But before I could close the action and pull the trigger, he lunged at me again. Now all I could do was cram the rifle sideways into his open mouth. With a violent jerk of his head, he wrenched the rifle from my grasp and flung it out of reach. He grabbed my foot in his teeth and shook me, and then still holding my foot, he started dragging me, and he turned and ran toward the other lions, which is not good. Believe me, in lion-dealing things, if they're dragging you toward the other lions, that's not good. His path took me past my rifle. I grabbed it, worked the bolt, stuck the muzzle in his ear, and pulled the trigger. Nothing. Desperately, I worked the action and shut and open and shut again and jerked the trigger. Nothing. The magazine couldn't be empty. I told myself it holds 4 rounds. I'd only fired 3. I clawed the bolt open and made a terrifying discovery. When the lion had snatched the rifle out of my hands, his teeth had pierced the stock and bent the magazine, hopelessly pinning the remaining cartridge in the magazine. The gun was jammed. Until that awful realization, I felt I was on top of the situation. Even when the beast was dragging me by the foot, but now the weight of my predicament came crashing down. I knew I was done for. And that's when the lion came for his head. Now we'll finish that story later. Stop and think, though. The graphic imagery of a lion. 1 Peter chapter 5. Now we've read this before. I have a small collection that's about 5 feet of bookshelf of books that have stories like this in them, written by people who have experienced it. This is actually taken from an Outdoor Life magazine article in 1977 about this fellow's name, the one that's being chewed on by the lion. His name is Lou Games, L-E-W Games. And the what happened in 1965. In verse 9 of 1 Peter chapter 5, we read a very familiar scripture. We've often thought about, and I'm hoping that after the sermon, you'll think about more realistically than ever. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. So be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, and of course it's a reference to Satan, walks about like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. Now the lion was looking for the cattle, but when the man came down, it was going to attack him. I think that realizing the devil is our enemy, you know, we can say that and we can think about some of the analogies in the Bible. But it's good sometimes in an analogy to make it a little more graphic, make it a little more realistic. Like, for example, now you know that lions don't come in great leaps. When they're serious, they come like this, sort of a zigzag jerking motion as they dodge around through the brush. And they come fast. I'll read about how fast in a little bit here. The devil is our enemy. He is compared to a roaring, angry lion. And obviously this was a good example of an angry lion. It was very, very angry. He hates us as God's people and God's church. And he will destroy as many of us spiritually as he can. He is a destroyer. That's one of the terms used for Satan in the Bible, is a destroyer. He hates God. He hates God's plan of salvation for mankind. He hates everything about God's way of life. And he will attack all of these, sometimes in the open, sometimes very subtly. We need to be aware. We need to learn to be lion fighters. The official title is Fighting the Lion. The alternate title, which is usually how I refer to it, is the Lion Sermon. But let's think about the analogy just for a little bit here. A man-eating lion analogy. Now, you know, when you say that, you know, he goes about as an angry lion roaring and seeking whom he may devour, bear in mind a lion that devours people, because the context is people, is a man-eater. Man-eaters are rather terrifying kinds of cats. The man-eating lions have several approaches. There's a subtle approach of a lurking destroyer. Now let me read you the lurking destroyer story. This is from another book. That was the story by Lou Games. It was written actually, as he told it, it was written by a famous writer called Jim Carmichael. But this one is written by Peter Capstick. He has a series of books of his experiences working in Africa. The spore, by the way, S-P-O-O-R, it's not from mushrooms, it is a trail, tracks, any kind of sign on a trail that you would track. The spore told the whole story. A rounded edge of half moon was just beginning to creep over the black horizon as the lion covered the last few feet of the edge of the sleeping village. It's an African village. He could surely smell the human odor mixed with the smoky scent of dying campfires, urine, and stale cecuela beer, the homebrew beer. His praying eyes slipped carefully across the village, but all was still, none of the hairless animals in sight. In a low, hunch-shouldered crouch, he slinked toward the rear of darkened hut. You say, well, how do they know he did that? Well, trackers in Africa, some of the best ones are the Bushmen from the Kalahari, but there are very excellent trackers in any of the tribes that still live out in the bush to some degree, and a lot of white men who have learned to track as well. You can tell by the way the feet are moved, how far they're moving, where the balance of the animal is, and the depth of the the pug mark. That's a cat doesn't make a track. It's usually referred to, it is a track, but it's usually referred to as a pug mark because their claws are retracted while they're moving across, you know, the land. They only get the claws out when they're in the fighting mode. So they can read this in the tracks, how he moves, slinking slowly, his feet not moving very far at a time because he's sneaking. His huge paws soundless against the packed red clay, but there was enough dust on the red clay to see the track. He stopped. The heat of the African night pressed heavily against him, and as he paused, the hush of quiet breathing came to his pricked up ears. Flattened to the ground, and they will be able to see where he then flattened down, like you see the cat flattened down when it's getting ready to run after a squirrel or something. Flattened to the ground, he crept across the open space between the two huts and froze into tawny stone as he watched three huddled forms in the shadows against the side of the hut, near the dying embers of a small fire. He lay perfectly still for several moments, deciding which man would die. Then he began to flow through the shadows toward the three deeply sleeping men. They're sleeping off too much beer. He passed the first two, sniffing softly at their heads, and stood over the closest to the mud wall. His jaws opened, and the long white canines drove into the unsuspecting victim's temple. The man gave a single convulsive tremor and lay still. Without releasing his grip, the lion tugged, gently pulling the body from between the hut and the sleepers a few inches away, and when it was clear, the man-eater straddled the corpse, holding it by a limp shoulder, dragged it across the open and into the blackness of the bush. All of that can be told by the track in the sand. The lion easily carried his kill for 3 miles, pausing only to shift his grip twice. A dark green stretch of towering chondritum type of brush loomed ahead in the moonlight, and the killer made for it, dragging the man deep into one of the tunnels of the tangled boughs. A single hyena had crossed the blood spore and followed the lion, but a threatening rumble from the man-eater kept the other animal shuffling 20 feet away. And then it tells how he ate it, which I won't read that paragraph, because they'll put you right off our snacks afterwards. See, sometimes the devil attacks subtly, slinking through the night, sniffing this one, sniffing that one, killing that one, and drags them out without waking anybody up. And the next morning, you know, where's their buddy? When they look at the tracks, they suddenly know. The man who wrote the story had to hunt down the man-eater. But his tracker also read the tracks and knew exactly what was happening. Now you think, well, yeah, but where does it have that kind of imagery in the Bible? Let's go to Psalm 10. You know, when you stop and think about it, sometimes you find out the Bible is a more exciting book, just as a book, to read than you thought. And God uses analogies quite dramatically. Now, I don't know if David wrote this one. I think probably it was one of David's. It doesn't have his signature on it. But Psalm 10, and it's a song of confidence in God's triumph over evil, and you know, who the David praying for God's intervention. Why do you stand afar off, O Eternal? Why do you hide in times of trouble? The wicked in his pride persecutes the poor. Let them be caught in the plots which they have devised. For the wicked boasts of his heart's desire. He blesses the greedy and renounces the Lord. Well, in the world, we can certainly see that happening. The wicked in his proud countenance does not seek God. God is in none of his thoughts. His ways are always prospering, but your judgments are far above, out of his sight. As for his enemies, he sneers at them. He has said in his heart, I shall not be moved. I shall never be in adversity. His mouth is full of cursing and deceit and oppression, and under his tongue is trouble and iniquity. Now, you see, well, you're looking at this crazy man, crazy spiritually, and you think, but he doesn't have any effect on us. Oh, yes. See, that's the subtle part, isn't it? Satan works through people who get to other people. Continuing to talk about the same character that we just described, in verse 8, he sits in the lurking places of the villages, in between the huts. In the secret places, he murders the innocent, like the poor guy who was the lion's dinner. His eyes are secretly fixed on the helpless. is what the lion, as soon as he spotted them, he, you know how a cat will stare at what it's going to go after? Like he's trying to make it sit still by staring at it. At least Winston does that. And he's one of our cats. He lies in wait secretly as a lion in his den. Ah, so the analogy is about a man-eating lion is what this character described early in the psalm is like. In other words, he's letting Satan use him to attack others subtly. He lies in wait secretly as a lion in his den. He lies in wait to catch the poor. He catches the poor and he draws him into his net. In this case, it was a net of conbredum, which is a type of tangly brush. So he crouches, he lies low, that the helpless may fall by his strength. And he said in his heart, in effect, God has forgotten, he hides his face, he'll never see me. It's a sobering psalm, isn't it? And the rest of it, though, is triumphant, because God's a lion fighter. Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up your hand, do not forget the humble. Why do the wicked renounce God? He has said in his heart, you will not require an account. But you have seen, for you observe trouble and grief, to repay it by your hand. The helpless commits himself to you. You are the helper of the fatherless. You break the arm of the wicked and the evil man. You seek out his wickedness until you find none. The Lord is king forever and ever. The nations have perished out of his land. Lord, you have heard the desire of the humble, and you will prepare their heart, and you will cause your ear to hear, to do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed, that the man of the earth may oppress no more. So we have here those people who are oppressors, in one way the subtle oppressors, not the attackers, the lion that attacked Lou Gaines wasn't particularly subtle, except that it used the screen of brush to surprise it. The lion in the village that killed the man who had too much beer. Now that was the subtle approach, and that's what's described here. Lions do it that way. Or they can be arrogant attackers. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. I've been working on my outline for it. I have to teach Satan the devil, that one of our fundamental doctrines, which, of course, to do that, you have to explain who the angels all are. So I've been working on the devil scriptures, making my list of them. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Here we go. Start in verse 3, begins the sentence, but even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is in the image of God, should shine on them. The God of this age, or the God of this world, and Satan is at that, he's a king of beasts in that sense, the ruler of this age. Christ referred to him as the ruler of the age. And the age is from the Greek word cosmos, which sometimes is translated world, just in the sense of our world versus the ancient world. It uses it as age as well. Let me give you a little bit of background on lions that help appreciate the analogies a little bit more before we get back to this poor guy hanging on to the lion's tongue. Don't forget about him. The lion, Panthera leo, once ranged all through Africa, except for the heavily forested and great elevated regions, in early historic times and inhabited Eastern Europe to Romania, and quite probably Italy, and ranged thence east through Turkey and the Caucasus to central India. All of the Near East was included in its range. That would include Israel. We know that. Why? Because Samson killed one and used it for a beehive. And David had killed at least one in hand-to-hand combat when it was trying to snitch his sheep and cattle. And Benaiah the Heavy fell on one and killed it. Benaiah, he was one of David's mighty men. We call him sometimes Benaiah. Benaiah the Heavy, because it says in one place that he fell on five men and killed them. And so that's not what it really doesn't mean, that he fell on them and killed them. But he was one of the great lion fighters of the Bible, because it says, on a snowy day, and the detail was inspired to be added, on a snowy day, he went into a pit and killed a lion. You know, hand-to-hand combat. What weapon, we don't know. You know, they think, well, how could a human possibly, like David, grab the lion by its beard, by its mane, and killed it? Well, that'd be knife work. Or maybe a short thrusting spear, I'm not sure. But how can a man do that? Well, I've read the accounts of several men who have killed leopards, full-size leopards. Now, granted, they're a lot smaller than lions, but they weren't nearly as strong as David. One was Jean-Pierre Hallet, who was a Belgian who took up the cause of the pygmy tribes in the Ituri forest in the 50s and 60s. And at one point, he had one hand blown off by dynamite. He had been dynamiting fish in a lake over a mountain range from where the pygmies lived during a time that they had a famine. Every day he would go over and dynamite a bunch of fish, load them into the truck, and drive them over the pass to feed the villagers that were in the area that was stricken by a famine. It was the last load of fish. Standing in the dugout canoe, he'd lit the dynamite, and then he would hold it to the fuse that was about right, and he'd toss it out there, and it would explode, and a bunch of fish would then float, and he'd just load them into the dugout. Well, short fuse, boom, there went his hand. Why it didn't kill him is because there was no resistance. He was just blown straight over, so it just took his hand off, fortunately. So he was leading a trek through the forest, and the leopard dropped down on one of the men that was carrying the loads. He then tackled the leopard from behind and killed it with a knife, which is pretty good. He only got one good hand. You know, you got an arm, but you don't have the hand on the other side. So he did that, and there was a man named Carl Ackley, who a scientist and researcher in the early part of the 20th century, that had to kill a leopard without a knife. He actually had to strangle it, smother it. He stayed behind it to do that, otherwise he would not have survived. So men have been able to do that. So Benaiah was a mighty man of David, and David was fiercely mighty himself as far as strong and tough. So taking on a lion, and the lions of the Near East, there are various subspecies of lions, but the lions of the Near East were slightly smaller than the African lions, the largest getting up to about 350 pounds. So you could handle that probably, 350 pound lion. The African ones, they average about 400 to begin with, and then the big ones will get up to 500 to 550. The man-eating lions of Tsavo. This would be about 1899. The British were building a railroad between from Uganda down to Mombasa on the Indian Ocean. And there was a bridge that had to be built. And these two man-eating lions started killing so many of the workers that it stopped. Nobody wanted to work there. So they all left. And the only way he could get the bridge built, it was an Irishman who was in the British Army. He was an engineer. Is he had to hunt these two lions down himself. Nobody else could seem to catch up with them, so he finally did. They made a great movie out of that, which is fairly close to the real deal stuff, except that no, there was no Michael Douglas who died in it. That was called Ghosts in the Darkness. But they do a really good job of giving you the sense of how scary it would be to be in the dark, knowing that there's a man-eating lion stalking you. Well, think about how scary it is when we have a man-eating, spiritual man-eater, stalking us. Anyway, where was I? All the Near East is included in the range except Arabia. Today, a few apparently still occur in the south of the Sahara, reportedly in Morocco. And a small population enjoys a measure of protection in the Gir Forest in the Gujarat region of India. So there is a lion population in a part of India. Popular literature usually characterizes the lion as a creature of the jungle, but nothing could be further from the truth. It's an animal of the open bush and the savanna, the great grass plains that cover so much of Africa. You're more apt to find one in a desert than in a forest. The lion, interestingly, is not the largest of the cats. That honor belongs to the Siberian tiger, which exceeds it both in length and weight. Second, though it may be, it's still a large animal. It can approach 11 feet in length, measuring from the tip of the tail to the tip of the nose, and 42 inches or more in height at the shoulder. 400 pounds is a good figure for a large specimen, and a number have exceeded it. Now, when I say the Siberian tiger is actually bigger than a lion, that's not the orange and black ones in India. This is the Siberian tiger, I think, is the white and black one. This next note will be interesting. Tigers are really just lions with stripes. And lions are really just tigers without stripes. Lions are anatomically very close to tigers, and with their skins off, the two animals are all but indistinguishable by anyone but an expert. The two cats can readily interbreed, giving ligers and tiglons. A liger is when the lion is the father, and a tiglon is when the tiger is the sire of the young. So when you realize that, then you can, when you're talking about man-eating lions, you can throw in man-eating tigers, because they're essentially the same. If they crossbreed that readily, there's just two different varieties of the same kind. And then we want to talk about man-eaters. There's a fascinating little book, which I have two copies of, called The Man-Eaters of Kumaon. Kumaon is a northern province in India that butts right up against the Himalayan mountains, just over the passes from Nepal. Written by a man named Jim Corbett, he wrote six books. Five of them are about his experience of growing up in India. He hunted in the first 40 years of the 20th century. He hunted up in the northern parts of India where he lived. He hunted most of the man-eating tigers and leopards on his own. Especially the ones that nobody else could get. Because when a cat went man-eating, then the government specifically wanted it destroyed, and so did the people, because it would shut down an entire region. The tigress of Chowargah is one of the worst. She was mentioned in British Parliament once. She had killed over 625 known kills. 625. They estimate there are probably that many more that they didn't know about. But they have documented that many before Jim Corbett finally put it into her career. And then he had leopards. One leopard killed over 400 people. So Africa and India had been plagued with the man-eaters before. So when you stop and think about it, that's just scary. They would abandon their villages in the hills and go back to the city. And, you know, they wouldn't have any, in those days they didn't have any safety net for people like that, so they had to go and hunt down the man-eaters so people could go back to work and live where they lived. That's some interesting things about lions. They are distinct in appearance. They differ as much, the game rangers can identify the individuals in a pride just as easily as they can see people that they recognize, but lions differ as much in disposition as they do in appearance. It's not only in children's books that we can find the lazy lion and the happy lion and the timid lions and the brave ones. The author that writes this is, I forget his name, but I got it written down here. The author is not fond of writing, of attaching human emotions to animals, but lion emotions can be characterized as a full gamut of emotion. One lion will stroll down a well-trafficked street on the outskirts of Nairobi in Kenya, indifferent to screaming mothers and honking car horns, while another will be panicked by a sheet on a clothesline. Some individuals will go placidly through life showing real animation only when really pressed by outside influences or internal stirrings. Others will fly off into regular tantrums at the least of causes. So that's interesting. It's kind of like people in a sense. In that particular way. So the king of beasts can be an arrogant attacker and an angry tyrant. Thirdly, as we're filling out the analogy, then we're going to look at some other aspects of lions. Let's go to Revelation chapter 12. You know this one. This is the end time prophecy about how Satan will be. Now maybe now when you read it, it has more dynamics to it. I wouldn't say pizzazz I wouldn't give the devil the benefit of having any pizzazz, but dynamics. Verse 7, and war broke out in heaven. And Michael is an archangel, and his angels fought, and the dragon with the dragon and the dragon and his angels fought. The dragon is Satan, of course. But they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. That is, the dragon and his angels, which would be Satan and the demons. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast out to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So people read this and say, okay, we know that it was a third of the angels from another scripture. And we know that there was a rebellion. So they think this is it. This is actually the second battle that we are aware of. There was the primary battle of the original rebellion. This is not it. And the reason is, it was Michael and his angels who fought against the devil and his angels. The other comment about the original rebellion is made by Christ himself when he sent the disciples out to cast out demons, heal the sick. It was a test run in Luke chapter 10. And I will actually, let me just give it to you now. We won't necessarily turn to it later. It's verse 18. And the story is, his statement is simple, but the story is he sent the disciples out two by two, go out and preach the gospel of the coming kingdom, or the kingdom of God, and heal the sick, and cast out, you know, those who have demons. And there were many who did at the time. And so they did it, and they came back, and they were amazed. They were energized. All the disciples were excited about, you know, the fact that the demons left when they told them to go in the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And Christ, in essence, makes a side comment, as if to say, small wonder, because I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. See, there was another time, the original time, when Satan rebelled and attacked the throne of God. Christ is the one who put him down then. At the end time, he doesn't even get the respect of the great Messiah, being the one who vanquishes him. His peer, Michael, is sent to vanquish him. Now, when that happens, and we don't know if it has happened yet, sometimes you look at world events and the way the pace is picked up, it makes you wonder if this hasn't happened. Because in verse 10 it says this, I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, saying, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ has come, for the accuser of our brethren, and the word devil comes from diablo, which means accuser or slanderer, the accuser of our brethren who accused them before our God day and night has been cast down. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives to the death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them, and woe to the inhabitants of the earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, an angry tyrant. A great wrath because he knows he has but a short time. Well, in the context of Revelation, we read the short time indicating that this then is a battle that takes place in the end time that is different from the original rebellion of Satan. Because Christ himself cast him down at that time. So we have a man-eating lion analogy that includes the sneaky, subtle approach, a whispering campaign that Satan must have used to deceive and to lure, you know, a third of the angels to following him. The arrogant attacker, and that's for the charging lion. Oh, we didn't read about how lions charge. I have a great thing about that. Lion charges. When we talk about the arrogant attacker, similar to the one that Lou Gaines is in the middle, he's got his tongue, his fists around the tongue right now. Simba often shows unsure table manners about just what to do with a human when he catches up with one that has bestirred his ire. Lion charges are among the great classic animal behavior patterns in Africa. Far and away, the great preponderance of charging lions are those who have been wounded or at least molested, bothered. A lion with several hundred grains of East Alton, Illinois, Cupro jacketed irritation in his guts, that's a bullet, is certainly in an uncontested running for the title of the scariest animal on earth. And a preview of his proposed performance does little to deny it. But a lion starts off, here's how the charge happens. A lion starts off at a speed that most of the other big fighters can't manage even after they've built up the momentum. Now, the big five in big game hunting circles are the elephant, the Cape buffalo, the rhinoceros, the leopard, and the lion. And everybody argues about what order they should come in. But none of the others can get up to the speed. Well, all right, the rhinoceros can probably do it. A rhinoceros can run as fast as a horse. And for quite a ways. That's not bad when you weigh 3 tons. Be sure you're chasing him and not him chasing you. But the lion starts about that speed. And the rhino can only get somewhat close to it as he gets his momentum moving. The leopard is smaller and faster, but whoever came up with the platitude cat quick was thinking of old Simba. When he comes for you, there's no doubt about it. Considerably faster than a horse from a standing start, he barrels through the brush and grass, grunting in determination, fit to give a crusader loose bowels. You'll read about his springing and other time-wasting time motions, but it is generally not so. The lion comes in a yellow beige streak, low to the ground in a gliding rush led by a vertical corona of mane bristling as if with static, a setting that surrounds a pearl and coral matrix of mouth the size of a reasonable watermelon. How fast? Trust me. Though I've never timed one, I would guess about 40 miles an hour. Some say more, some less. Whatever, it's a very large package of claws, teeth, and determination that takes an astonishing short time to get to you if you don't donate something over 375 caliber to it in one big hurry. It's called shooting it. Now, that was Peter Kapstick again. He worked as a game control officer in Kenya and Botswana for a number of years in addition to being a professional hunter. So he had to hunt down man-eating lions. He has the experience. He knows what he's talking about. That's how fast they are. That's why when they charge, they charge. Now, the lion-like methods of the devil. Let's look at this. 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 11. Amazing how much we know about the devil based on what Paul wrote. Added to all the other things. 2 Corinthians 2. Here we have the simple statement. It's in the context of a story. We may go back to that story in a minute. Lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. Or are we? Sometimes I wonder if we aren't ignorant of his devices. Ignorant because maybe we haven't studied his devices well enough. Ignorant because we maybe sort of think human nature is not so bad. You know, the liberals of this world, the classic liberals, they started their way of thinking back in the 1600s during the Enlightenment period, which was sort of a casting away of the Catholic line of reasoning. Catholics think that everybody is born evil, you know, because of the original sin and that kind of thing, and even babies are evil and so on. That's been their doctrine for hundreds of years. The thinkers during the Enlightenment period of the mid-1600s began to think anything the Catholics thought, they wanted to think differently. So they decided that human nature was fundamentally good down underneath. They'd have bad stuff around it, but fundamentally it was good. And that is consistent with the way even our modern-day liberals in America and most countries think that human nature is basically good. We know it's not basically good. The kind of human nature that we grow up and develop by taking in Satan's broadcast. So we need to be aware that we understand the nature of the devil because we have so much of it woven into our fabric that we're trying to get rid of. Let's look at several of his tactics. Or his devices, or methods. Methods is another way it can be translated. In chapter 11, same spot here, same book, we look at one. This is deceit. Who deceives the whole world, as we've already read that in Revelation 9 or 12 and verse 9. But here is another elaboration on how the God of this age is a deceiver. Paul is talking about those who claim to be faithful ministers of the church, and yet they constantly were attacking him and those who were working with him. They were the ones who were spearheading the work, and he was responsible for the Gentile areas of the world. That was Paul's responsibility. Peter had to look after the areas primarily where the Jews were, because the Jews were the ones who still practiced circumcision for males, and the Israelites, maybe, depending on whether they still had that as a practice, depending on where they were. But Peter had to look after the Jewish world. Paul had to look after the non-Israelite world. And then there were these men that were traveling around where Paul's work was being done, who were claiming to be apostles themselves and having greater authority than him, and constantly attacking and slandering him. Verse 12. But what I do, I will also continue to do, that I may cut off the opportunity from those who desire an opportunity to be regarded just as we are in the things of which they boast. These guys were charlatans. And maybe they've been a part of the ministry in the church, who knows? We don't have that detail. But they were making like they were, at least. For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. And no wonder. Marching orders came from someplace. For Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers transform themselves into the ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works. So Paul wasn't dealing with ministers that were in some other Christian organization, because there weren't any. The church was it. So this was actually some that were somehow within the orbit of the church. But not a good thing. Lions are great with camouflage. You think, well, how do you mean they're great with camouflage? They don't have any spots. They live in the plains. They can sit stock still. And they disappear in the shortest of grass. You know, they're very well designed for where they live. Now, tigers, which are like lions, of course, as we already discussed, they tend to live in jungles a lot more and into molted shadows. So the stripy business, man, they're just gone. As soon as they step into the slight shadow, they disappear from sight. Camouflage. That's what deceit is. We have to be aware of that. We don't want to see it in ourselves. We don't want to see it in others in the church, because that pulls us apart. We need to be upfront and honest and open and not try to be who we aren't. Be faithful and supportive of what Christ is doing in the church and the work that is being done through all of that. So, we already talked about the camouflage, how the lion would freeze in tableau. Theodore Roosevelt went on a huge safari in 1910 to 1911. It was just after he got done being president. 11 months long. His wife went with him for the first few months up to a certain point, then she traveled back up the Nile, and his son Kermit traveled with him the rest of the time. He collected most of the specimens that are in the Chicago Museum of Natural History. That was the museum that he was doing the shooting for, and brought back a huge collection of a variety of animals. But he talks in his book, African Game Trails, talks about how there were two lions out in grass that couldn't be more than 6 inches high, but in the bright sun, when they went still, they just disappeared. So he had to gallop his horse out there to make a move so he could find them. Theodore Roosevelt was never bashful. Now, go back, if you would, to 2 Corinthians chapter 2 again, where we were, about the devil's devices. We have the situation that this is the resolution of. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, we read that passage all the time around Passover. 1 Corinthians 5, there's this man who's shacking up with his stepmother, apparently. And Paul says that he he's allowed to attend church, and the brethren were proud of the fact that they could allow him to attend church in spite of the fact that he was a blatant adulterer. And Paul said, he's going out. You put him out of the church now. Now, Paul was he was on the case of the ministry in Corinth as well as the membership, because obviously that was something that should have been done. So he said he has to be removed and he needs to be turned over to Satan. In other words, removed from the church, out from under the protection that God provides his people spiritually in so many ways. And why would he be delivered? The term was delivered to Satan. deliver such a one to Satan. Why would he be delivered to Satan? Well, hopefully the shock impact would cause him to repent. That's the whole plan behind that. Now in chapter 2 of 2 Corinthians, this man has repented. Now, Paul cracked a big whip in 1 Corinthians over the heads of the brethren and the ministry in Corinth. And did they ever respond? They sobered up fast. This man was out instantly. And then they were hesitant about letting him come back after he had, mended his ways and repented of his sins. So Paul then goes into this paragraph that starts in verse 5. But if anyone has caused grief, he has not grieved me, but all of you to some extent, not to be too severe. This punishment, which was inflicted by the majority, is sufficient for such a man. By the majority, meaning that he was disfellowshipped from the bulk of the church. So that, on the contrary, you ought rather to forgive and comfort him. Because obviously the repentance has taken place. Lest perhaps such a one is swallowed up by too much sorrow. Therefore, I urge you to reaffirm your love to him, for to this end I also wrote that I might put you to the test, whether you are obedient in all things. Well, they had been obedient, and now they had to do this. Now, whom you forgive anything, I also forgive. For if indeed I have forgiven anything, I have forgiven that one for your sakes in the presence of Christ, lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. So you see, that's how it fits into the story. Satan can work where there is too much sorrow. So finding ways to encourage people. Build bridges. Periodically we end up having people in one organization or another organization, or maybe no organization of the church, and they're just drifting. You build bridges to where you give some encouragement. It's not like you can give the encouragement on the Sabbath when they aren't attending the church, but you give them encouragement as well. My family are a part of a different organization of the church. And this happened about 12 years ago. But we determined that when that happened that we would simply keep the bridges in extremely good repair, and so we have. And we've been thankful for all the blessings of that. Let me show you, though, how Satan creates fear and discouragement. And that he was putting the discouragement in this man who needed a little fear put into him. And he got the fear put into him, but he was discouraged by the fact that he was continued to be rejected even though he had repented. But man-eating lions can do that. So let's go back to 2 Kings chapter 17. If you're a Tribe Trackers fan, you know that 2 Kings 17 is a really important chapter because it chronicles the invasions and captivities of the northern kingdom of Israel. And when they're all gone, the Assyrians brought in these other people from over around Babylon and planted them around the capital city of what had been the northern kingdom of Israel, the house of Israel. The capital city was Samaria. So these people later, eventually over the years, then became known as Samaritans, when in fact they aren't Israelites at all. They're just named after the location they were settled in. So in verse 24, the king of Assyria brought, this is verse 24, chapter 17 of 2 Kings. The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon and Kutah and Ava, Hamat, and from Sabraim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and dwelt in its cities, so all the satellite cities around it, which is all within the inheritance of Manasseh, interestingly. And it was so at the beginning of their dwelling there that they did not fear the Lord. They didn't know God from anything. Therefore, the Eternal sent lions among them, which killed some of them. And if they killed them, the chances are very high they also ate them. So they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations whom you have removed and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the rituals of the god of the land. See, they believe they're pagans, and they think there's a god of every land, so you have to placate him. So he has sent lions among them, and indeed they're killing them because they don't know how the rituals of the god of the land. So they sent a priest back, and he taught them, and that's why they blended the Babylon mystery religion they brought from over by Babylon, all those areas are from over there that they came from, blended that with God's truth, what the priests knew of it. Bear in mind that the priests from the northern house of Israel weren't all that up to date on their conduct and teaching. You see, the man-eaters can just stop somebody in their tracks. Man-eating lion. Satan can do that too. The the man-eating lions of Tsavo. I just mentioned that a little bit earlier. Let's see what happened there. Here it is. The most famous of man-eating lions were those of Tsavo. And they stopped the building of the entire track until it was finally hunted down, or they were finally hunted down and killed by Patterson, who was the British officer in charge of building the bridge. The summary here is, what happened at Tsavo, Tsavo is spelled T-S-A-V-O, Tsavo, at the Tsavo construction sites and subsequently in surrounding territory for several years has no known explanation. The cats involved were acting in an abnormal manner. They killed these two massive man-eaters that killed dozens of the Indian national workers that were over there building the railroad, and they killed maybe hundreds of African tribesmen in that area. Because they found where they carried their dead, and there were stacks of bones that were left there from their feasts. And there's just two males, maneless males, two big, fat, maneless males, because people have a high fat constitution, I guess. You know, the cannibals of Africa refer to eating human as eating long pig, because human flesh and pig flesh is very, very close. And that's why they can take the artery of a 70-pound wiener pig and use it for bypass operations, because the body doesn't tend to reject it. It's really similar. Now give that some thought next time you watch somebody eating a ham sandwich. Yeah. Now, if it ever, you have those lingering thoughts, you know, it's usually from the smell, which is connected to the memory so well. And if you grew up eating porky pig, you know, in a frying pork chop or something like that, the smell just brings back these comfort feelings. Well, just think about the smell of long pig. I have curious. That smell won't have any attraction at all if you think about long pig for a while. All right, where was I? The cats involved were acting in an abnormal manner for reasons completely unknown, and they turned away from the normal prey and took the human flesh. Unfortunately, there's no way of knowing when and where it will happen again. Aberrant behavior. Now that leads us to another aspect. Satan is deceitful, he's got camouflage, the next point we just looked at is he creates fear and discouragement. He also creates confusion and fear. Now, we know that. You can make a reference to this, 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and verse 33. God is not the author of confusion. Satan is. That's why the statement, God is not the author of confusion. They were talking about confusion in the church service and how it needed to be conducted, and Paul wanted it to be orderly. And that's the way one of these writers tells about how lions hunt. The killers are actually the lionesses, not the lions themselves. But the way they hunt in groups, the pride group that goes out to hunt, they find a small herd or even a couple of individuals of ungulates. That means bovine or ungulates, which are the deer, the antelope. And then the lionesses will go downwind in their path of confusion, the path of the prey animal's confusion. And then some of the lions will go upwind. And so when the antelope have their wind or the buffalo or whatever it is they've decided to eat, it starts to run away, in a sense, in confusion, run away from the smell of danger right into the jaws of danger, the jaws of death. And that's the end of them. Now that's how lions hunt. And Satan loves to cause confusion. You know, he sends up a smoke screen or gives off some kind of scent and we go run in one direction or another, but we must beware. He has a nasty plan. There's one other aspect about how Satan's tactics are. It's an insane influence, which, you know, sometimes in extreme cases it's possession. And I'm not talking just about the individual. And there were many that had devils, demons cast out of them in those days. But why some animals become man-eaters? Just as I said, there's the man-eaters of Tsavo there was no reason why. There was plenty of game, but they just decided to eat people. Sometimes a man-eater is old and weak and can't catch anything but a slow-running human being. But just as often and even more often, they're healthy animals that just decide to eat people. Often juvenile males who have not mated. But it could also be females too. They are kind of demonic at times, the man-eaters are. Now, that insane influence is kind of contagious. The spirit of the age. Notice this passage in Jude. It's only one chapter, so I won't tell you what chapter it is. Beloved, I was very diligent, verse 3, to write to you concerning our common salvation. I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith which once for all was delivered to the saints. For certain men have crept in unnoticed, who have long ago were marked out for this condemnation, ungodly men who turn the grace of our God into lewdness and deny our Lord God and the Lord Jesus Christ. Some who came into the church, we've seen this happen before, we must be aware, and cause confusion. But I want to remind you, which is why he's trying to replace the confusion with sensible thinking, I want to remind you that though you once knew this, that the Lord, having saved the people of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe. And the angels, who did not keep their proper domain, but left their abode, you know, where God placed them, he has reserved in everlasting chains of darkness for judgment of that great day. Not unlike how he destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, and he gives that, except Sodom and Gomorrah won't be an eternal punishment. The demonic hordes will have a punishment that lasts forever. Likewise, these dreamers in verse 8, you know, blending the concept of the demons and with the human beings that act like that, under that influence of all of the tactics of Satan, defile the flesh, reject authority, speak evil of dignitaries. Yet Michael, the archangel, contending with the devil when he disputed the body of Moses, didn't even bring a reviling accusation, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." Now, if Michael could rebuke anybody, you'd think it would have been the devil. They probably were of the same rank, archangels, cherubim perhaps. But these speak evil of whatever they don't know. And whatever they know naturally, like brute beasts, again, reference to lions in this, you know, general sense. In these things they corrupt themselves. Woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain and run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit and perished in the rebellion of Korah. We don't want to be among them at all. So you must be cautious. We are to be lion fighters. There were great lion fighters. We cited Samson, we cited David, we cited Benaiah, but there was also Daniel. Daniel fought lions in the lion's den, or the pit where they threw him, by standing very still and praying. It's a good tactic. The Apostle Paul, 1 Corinthians 15:32, you can read it later. It seems like the Apostle Paul also had to fight lions. It is a little bit obscure reference. It was in Ephesus, and it talks about fighting beasts. Maybe they were men who were acting like beasts, like we read here in Jude, in their conduct and their behavior, who should have been not acting like that because of what they knew. Or it was that he had to fight a gladiator-type session with a lion, and he survived. Little old Paul, and then all the traditions are that he was kind of a small guy. But the greatest lion fighter of them all, when we realize that Satan is a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour, the greatest lion fighter of them all is Jesus Christ. And the example for you to read and meditate on later, because I would like us to turn back simply to James. The example is in Matthew 4 and Luke 4 when he was confronted by Satan and tempted by Satan. You'll get back to James chapter 4. I'm going to tell you how Lou Gaines got out of his predicament here. All right, we left him with his fists full of cat tongue and one elbow jammed into the corner of the cat's jaw so it couldn't bite his head off, which was good. And he heard flies buzzing around, and then he heard another roar, and it was the engine of the truck. He forgot about his friend in the truck. It came directly from behind the lion. I couldn't see it, but I heard it. And I heard the door open. I said, "Stay in the truck. I got to get the rifle," John shouted. I said, "The rifle won't work. Get back in the truck and run him over. But I'll run you over too. Getting killed by a truck is better than getting killed by a lion," I yelled. I'm going to have to drive closer. So he drove closer. As he drove closer, the lion got up then, because it would walk away and then lay on top of him, because it's holding onto his tongue, so it can't bite his head off. So the lion would lay on him, and then when he drove the truck, he'd get up and he'd try to drag him toward the other lions again. Finally, he came to this deep, dry wash. And he was trying to run over him, but he couldn't get the truck there quick enough. And first, the other lion started moving in, so he chased them off with the truck. And then he came back, and then the other lion followed them down into the dry wash and onto the other side. So he pulled up on the far side. It was a steep wash you couldn't drive a Land Rover through. And he said, there's a crossing a quarter of a mile up the way. And when you come down, come right after it, and I'll take it from there. So that's what he did. The other lions were starting to move back in. He roared up there, found the crossing, came roaring back, and went straight at the lion. And let me pick up the action. The truck was roaring straight on, and it was almost on top of us. I relaxed my grip on the tongue. Instantly, the lion whirled toward the truck and slashed at the fender with his forepaw. I was free, but the lion was between me and the truck. I scrambled up onto his back, and with a push from my good leg, catapulted from the lion's shoulder into the back of the truck. The lion sprang onto the hood, and for a terrifying instant, his teeth were only inches from John's face. Then, his strength gone, the lion slid backward off the hood, his claws gouging deep furrows in the metal. Now they had to get to the hospital because he can die from the infection of the puncture wounds. And that was another funny story. They ran back and poked in some kind of potassium compound that helps to sterilize the infection-causing bacteria. And then he grabbed all the liquor out of his liquor cabinet and started dousing himself with it on all of his wounds and drinking it. And they had to go 60 miles across one or two borders to get there, and they flagged them right on through because they called ahead. And he survived. A few scars, but he survived. The ironic thing, it wasn't a lion. It was a lioness. It was one of the very, very few instances where you have a maned lioness. Because it was a full mane on it, and it hardly ever happens. Maybe it was just a weird animal, I guess. Now, in James chapter 4 and verse 7, here's the key. We know what Satan's tactics are. So what do we do? Well, we fight. We defend. Therefore, submit to God, verse 7, resist the devil and he will flee from you. That's what saved this man's life. He resisted that devil of a lion, grabbed its tongue so it couldn't kill him, and then they found a way out, I think probably with a bit of God's blessing. Satan is a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour, but we must resist him steadfast in the faith, and he will flee from us. There's one final little quote I want to read to you. This is from another book by the other author. When the fire is low and the razor blade of the moon is just a flicker, there's always a cry of old Africa. The call so clearly says that man will never completely dominate over the ancient land that controls the author's heart. He says, my heart. The Kai Swahili speakers understand the lion's long, as sort of a mock-up of his roar. I can't quite do it. A lot of diaphragm, though. They translate it best, I think. Interpreting the hollow, echoing challenges of Simba that roll across the liquid darkness of rivers and the muted greenish dun of plain from incredible miles as follows. Hainshi Yamini. Translate the tribesmen with a secret suppression of a shudder. Whose land is this? The big roars. Whose land is this? And then he ends the roars typically end with, ooh, 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 the big grunts that echo along. And they translate as, in their language, Yangu, Yangu, Yangu. Mine, mine, mine. So, devil's the god of this world. Whose land is this? Mine, mine, mine. Our response is wrong, wrong, wrong. This land is God's land, and we're a part of that.